Hello there, I'm Jason Shulman, and this is New Books in Australian and New Zealand Studies. My guest today on the podcast is Jeremy Martins. He's a senior lecturer in history at the University of Western Australia. He's here to talk about his new book, Empire and Asian Migration: Sovereignty, Immigration Restriction, and Protest in the British Settler Colonies, 1888 to 1907. It's published by UWA Publishing in 2018. Jeremy, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, Jeremy, it's great to have you on. So your book takes place at a really interesting historical moment. There are these colonies in the British Empire that have been granted internal sovereignty, but when it comes to imperial or foreign affairs, the colonial office still wants to be in charge. So tell us a bit about what's going on at the moment.
Well, in the late 1880s, as you said, most of the settler colonies that I am writing about in Australia, New Zealand, and South Africa have responsible government, which, as you say, is a form of internal sovereignty. So in relation to indigenous affairs, for example, these colonies largely have carte blanche to pass laws as they see fit. However, when it comes to external or imperial affairs, the imperial government in London retains the right to override these colonies in relation to imperial affairs. And so laws, for example, in relation to immigration or to other subjects that might impinge upon the imperial government's interests can be vetoed. And so I am interested in trying to see the ways in which this gap between sovereignty, internal sovereignty, and external kind of dependency creates all sorts of imperial tensions in relation to immigration.
And so your book, you know, looks at these different colonies. You mentioned Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, where there are populist settler protests regarding immigration and immigration restriction. Can you tell us a little bit about what the pattern was like for these settler protests?
Well, I found that in relation to immigration protests, you often see a pattern of popular, in some cases violent, protests organized by anti-Asian organizations or personalities within the white settler population. Many of them are actually elected officials or elected parliamentarians, I should say, and they are intent on forcing the government of the day, whether it's in Natal, South Africa, or whether it's in Sydney, New South Wales, to pass laws explicitly excluding Asian immigrants from entering those colonies. And the intent is to place pressure on the elected government of the day to pass laws that would restrict Asian migration. And again, going back to that issue around internal sovereignty but not international or imperial sovereignty, one of the reasons why there's a space is created for these protesters is because the colonies don't actually have the right to or the jurisdiction to pass laws that explicitly exclude Asian migration. They have to go via the colonial office in London. And so this gives a space to populist protesters who mobilize along racial lines and threaten violence.
What type of arguments did these, you know, white colonialists make to try to restrict Asian immigration?
They are largely racial arguments. This is the late 19th and early 20th centuries, and many of the explanations or rationalizations for exclusion are well known in relation to kind of racial thinking of the day. There's a mixture of kind of scientific racism, but it's got a lot to do with ideas around who is an appropriate settler and stereotypes around Asians, in particular around Asian migrants not requiring the same wages or the same standard of living as white settlers means that there's this argument that, well, Asian migrants will come and swamp the colonies, take away jobs and opportunities, and effectively squeeze out white settlers. And on top of that, there's this idea of the white man's colony or white men's colonies, which means that settlers adhere to an idea of settler colonialism that sees white settlers at the apex of the social and economic order, and any threat to their position is resisted. So really, the kinds of racial arguments you see range from everything around Asian migrants are not appropriate or not suitable to these colonies to really blatant racial stereotyping directed at Asians, either Chinese migrants in the case of Australia usually, but also in relation to Southern Africa migrants from India.
What does a comparative study with these different British colonies help you do that, you know, a study of just one of them wouldn't?
All right, so I'm interested as a historian of the British Empire. I'm interested in how things in one part of the empire are reflected or influenced in other parts of the empire. And I think a comparative approach to immigration protests and immigration restrictions allows one to see how there are similarities across the colonies, so for example in Australia and Southern Africa, but also how decision making in one place can have an impact, a very big impact on decision making in another place, and also how the colonial office in London kind of keeps in view what's going on in the different settler colonies and uses examples from one to suggest solutions to another, if that makes sense.
While people like Henry Parkes and other Australians were trying to limit Chinese immigration, there's a whole other story going on with the Japanese government. Tell us a little bit about how they fit into all this.
Well, what's interesting about Japan's situation is that in the late 19th, and we're talking mostly about the 1890s and into the early 20th century here, is that Japan and the United Kingdom are moving towards strengthening ties and signing alliances, which makes Japan and the United Kingdom allies. And this, of course, has to be seen in the context of the war between Japan and Russia and Japan's rising status and power within the Pacific and within in Asia generally. So the British government is interested in maintaining and extending this alliance with Japan. But of course, the white settler colonies, in particular those in Australia, are very keen to restrict Asian migration, and they see Japanese migrants in much the same way as they see Chinese migrants, that they should be restricted. And so what the Japanese government finds unacceptable about these laws passed in places like New South Wales and Victoria and elsewhere is that they lump together Japanese migrants with other Asian migrants, which is seen as an offensive attempt to denigrate Japanese nationhood and identity. And so what you see is a concerted attempt by Japanese diplomats to use their relationship to the United Kingdom to pressure the colonial office in London to veto any laws that would restrict Japanese migration, or at least treat Japanese migrants in the same way as other Asian migrants are treated.
Tell us a little bit about the New Zealand experience, and maybe you could tell our listeners about Richard Seddon.
Well, Richard Seddon is a prime minister at the end of the 19th century and is into the early 20th century, and is a very strident racist when it comes to Asian migration to New Zealand. But in the episode that I focus on in this book is the part that he played in the aftermath of the Boer War, the South African War of 1899 to 1902, a war in which New Zealand soldiers fought alongside Australians and Canadians and other members of the British Empire. And what you see in the aftermath of that conflict in South Africa is the British colonial authorities in the newly conquered Transvaal making plans to import in Chinese labourers to work on the gold mines of Johannesburg and the surrounding areas, because what the war has done is it's basically shut down gold production, or at least severely restricted it, and in an attempt to get the gold mines operational again and productive, the plan is to bring Chinese mine workers on indenture to come over. And this is something that Seddon and others, but Seddon in particular, find unacceptable, and Seddon organizes as best he can to prevent the scheme from taking place. And he uses a kind of a proto-nationalist, if you like, argument, saying that, yes, New Zealand is a member of the British Empire, but New Zealanders have sacrificed their lives for South Africa in the recent war and sacrificed their lives for the empire. Therefore, we have a right as New Zealanders to have a say in this new scheme that's going to be you know, it's being proposed in this part of the world that we've sacrificed our lives to keep white. And so the intersection of kind of racial ideas around white men's countries, along with the belief that any kind of Chinese migration should be stopped, and also the idea that New Zealand is a nation that has a right to have a say in this, regardless of what the British government position is.
The book ends in 1907. Why is that? Why is that a historical turning point?
Well, I'm interested in, we haven't talked about the Gandhian protests in Southern Africa that are about to take off in 1907, but have just become, you know, it's become obvious that active nonviolence or satyagraha is an option that needs to be pursued as far as Indians in South Africa are concerned. But 1907 is also date in which New Zealand becomes a dominion. It's only a kind of a symbolic change from colony to dominion, but it's presented a useful endpoint, so to speak. It's also the year in which the Transvaal becomes a big colony with responsible government. So those things all come together in around about 1906, 1907.
What is looking at this, you know, 20-year period of anti-Asian immigration tell us about kind of the larger story of these former British settler colonies? I mean, the most obvious would be the legacy of the White Australia policy, but for all three, how does looking at this period kind of inform what takes place over the course of the 20th century?
Well, I think you're right. I think it's the, I live in Australia, obviously, and the legacy of the White Australia policy is very extensive. It's only dismantled, really, in the 1970s. The dictation test itself comes to an end in the 1950s, but White Australia as a policy lasts for, you know, three quarters of the 20th century, more or less. And we obviously, as people who follow the news know, Australia has a very punitive immigration regime. And I think there are, you know, without making it too simplistic, there are clear links between present immigration policy and the policies that have been practiced basically for the last 150 years at least. So there's that. I think also, obviously, protests against immigration are very much a thing of the present, and learning something about how governments try to navigate these popular protests, how they succumb to certain pressures but were able to negotiate others, is something that's useful for us in the present, given the importance of, more given the way in which contemporary politics has been influenced by fear of immigration, or dog whistling in relation to immigration, whether it's in Europe and North America or Australia.
Jeremy, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today. That's Jeremy Martins. He's a senior lecturer in history at the University of Western Australia. The new book is Empire and Asian Migration: Sovereignty, Immigration Restriction, and Protest in the British Settler Colonies, 1888 to 1907. It's published by UWA Publishing in 2018. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.